I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. Today, NATO nations subject to totalitarian propaganda in their media back genocide in Gaza, and today Sweden implicated in the persecution of WikiLeaks' Julian Assange, as well as being supplier of killing machines to Israel, looks set to join NATO. This as the USA is defeated in its proxy war with Russia through Ukraine, and the dollar loses its place as the currency of choice in global transactions. Charting how Ukraine became the decisive beginning of the end of US empire is Professor Glenn Deason. He's editor at the Russia in Global Affairs Journal, whose new book, The Ukraine War in the Eurasian World Order, illuminates the lethal lies and deceit of successive US and US proxy Western European nations. He joins me now from Oslo in Norway. Thank you so much, Professor Deason, for coming on. So I said two events today, which are emblematic of themes, really, in your must-read new book. I mean, it's quite an amazing summary of 500 years of neoliberal history. Hungary's vote on Sweden joining NATO, World Court hearings on NATO-armed Israel genocide activities in Gaza and Jerusalem. What did just those two events signify in terms of the panorama that you explain in your new book?
Well, those two events would are very significant. I guess the first would be the collapse of neutrality in Europe. Again, during the Cold War, we had a neutral belt going through the continent to give some strategic distance between the two rivals. And again, this was not as a favor to Moscow. This was seen as being in the national interest. Now we see states abandoning this, and largely without debate and without clear reasoning, why a successful policy of neutrality is replaced with extending a direct front line. And of course, it's the problems in Gaza has become quite a stain on the West as well, because I think around the world there's a lot of decline in the legitimacy, which is, of course, a key feature of world order, the legitimacy effectively to rule and to make up rules and implement those rules. And the legitimacy of the West is declining, as you know, everyone more or less recognizes a genocide, but there's still direct support for it. So it's a quite a dramatic time we live in.
Except that as the world is clearly opposed to Washington, EU, UK policy as regards Palestine, many of those who support Palestinian rights do not appear to understand Ukraine the way you detail it in the new book. I mean, Russia has just been victorious in Avdiivka. And today, Zelensky is saying today is a day of resistance against Crimea, or whatever it's called, according to Ukraine. Why do you think they don't see it, the European Union countries, some elements even in the Global South, and understand that Ukraine, as you detail, again and again, is a case, really, of NATO-backed genocide in eastern Ukraine, that Russia was going to defend the people in eastern Ukraine, and the fact that Ukraine is kind of an echo of Yugoslavia, which in most NATO countries in Western Europe, they're taught at school how Yugoslavia was a great freedom fight by NATO countries, and not, as you explain in the book, completely illegal under any facet of international law, as was then.
Well, to some extent, I argue it's also a decline of diplomacy, and this has been one of the curses of unipolarity. If you don't think you have any opponents to you, there's never any reasons to negotiate. Also, the whole idea of harmonizing and finding mutual interest is abandoned. And as we see now, diplomacy takes on largely this pedagogic function in which the West is the teacher and the other is the student. So, and the student isn't made compromise with it, it's to socialize. And if it doesn't allow itself to be socialized, they have to be contained or confronted. So there's a I guess there's a failure to address the key issues, and I think this is a key problem. I hear, you know, different Western leaders speak, and I never hear any of them being able to articulate the Russian position. And even if they were able to articulate it, they would be immediately attacked, because once you explain the opponent, you can be accused of legitimizing this. And this is the main problem, because there's so many objective realities in terms of how this war began, the development over the past 30 years, what sparked the war, and also how the war has been going. I mean, people have been thinking for 2 years that Ukraine was winning, because that's what they're being told. So there's a failure has been on many levels, and it tends to go back to the issue of the failure of unipolarity.
But just in the past few days, the government there in Norway, where you're speaking to be from, the defense minister, Bjorn Arild Gram, sending surface to air missiles to Zelensky, your prime minister, Jonas Gahr Støre, signing bilateral military agreements with Zelensky maybe in the next few weeks, they've announced there in Oslo, of course, home of is it the Nobel Peace Prize that they gave to Kissinger, who appears in your book quite a bit. I mean, just to take Norway as an example, what are they thinking?
Well, I think there's overall an absence of strategic thinking across NATO for that sake. It's there hasn't been any plans. We don't discuss how this war began, which means we can't really discuss how to solve it. And also, the assumption is NATO rejected all compromises. We don't even have diplomacy. Even the negotiations have become a naughty word. So the only possible outcome, acceptable outcome, is victory. But no one has defined what victory means. Are we going to defeat the world's largest nuclear power? Exactly how would this look like? So there's a lack of clarity in terms of what the actual goal is. And again, I don't think there's any good solutions to this. I think the key foundation of this miserable policies and failed policies which have been pursued is that it's the basic assumption that it's just unprovoked. Now, we're not allowed to contest that it was unprovoked, because if we say it was provoked, then you're legitimizing it. But by saying it was unprovoked, it suggests that Russia is simply out shopping for new territories, that this was opportunistic. And if that's the case, of course, you have to send weapons to increase the costs compared to the benefits of taking territory. However, if you recognize this was provoked, that Russia sees this as an existential threat, which is an objective reality, confirmed, again, 30 years from Washington as well, then sending all these weapons will merely escalate, because Russia can never step down or back off if the only option for victory, the only alternative, is for it to completely withdraw and see effectively NATO march in on Ukraine, in on Crimea as well. I think it goes back to this flawed assumption that this was unprovoked. And I think this is where a lot of the mistakes are born.
And not only the historic hatred of Russia that has been talked about quite a lot, at least by those who supported Putin's actions, the garden metaphor. I mean, I remember Rudyard Kipling, the claptrap orientalist writer, lauded when I was going to school. You explain where these words we heard from the EU Foreign Minister Josep Borrell talking about the rest of the world as a jungle and them as a garden, and how they keep reappearing, these kinds of phrases. Victoria Nuland's husband, Robert Kagan, talking about the importance of leading the world, and this dichotomy between garden and jungle. I don't know whether I'm in the jungle here in the UAE because I'm not in one of the metropoles of Western Europe.
Well, this actually has, as you suggested, a long history. Now, we say that the modern world order is based on Westphalia, in which every state was recognized to be sovereign. However, it soon became very evident that we did not have sovereign equality. Not all states had the same sovereignty. So sovereignty was something, not just a right, but also a responsibility. And the only one who were capable of upholding this responsibility were then Europeans, Christians. And the rest of the world were not civilized. They were not Europeans. They were not Christians. And so for this reason, they did not have the same sovereignty. This is, again, just an objective reality, that this is the system that was formed. And so under this system, there was the rhetoric which would merge was, this is the garden, which is the civilized Europe, and then you have the rest of the world, which is the jungle. And the basic assumption would be when we're in the garden, we have to respect the rule of law. But when we're in the jungle, we really have to go out and the rules no longer apply, because this is the rule of the jungle. So we don't have to follow the rules anymore once we're out in the wider world. Now, you can say that after the Cold War, after the Second World War, we began to drop a lot of this rhetoric about the civilized versus the barbarian. But we now, through ideology, reframed it as liberal democracies versus authoritarian states. And this is why this rhetoric has been revived, of the garden and the jungle. Again, it's not at some far periphery, even at the advisor to main advisor to Tony Blair when he came up with his liberal internationalism, called for a liberal empire, where he effectively used the same metaphor. We are the garden. We have to go out there to the jungle. And you see the same rhetoric also from the EU leadership, from Josep Borrell, who made this argument, again, just like Kipling. If we are the garden, we have built a system based on peace and law, but outside of our walls, there's a jungle. And if we don't go into the jungle and tame them, then the jungle will grow and grow into the garden. So there is this, it's a rhetoric of superiority in order to justify sovereign inequality. So sovereignty for us, but not for you. This is the basic idea.
Handy if you back genocide around the world and veto UN Security Council resolution, say on Gaza, if you actually believe that, of course. The NATO nation propaganda media has been lauding Navalny in Russia, who's marched with Nazis, of course, and backed Russia's retaking of Crimea. How do you think the Navalny case should be covered by this media, and who benefited from his killing or his death just before the Munich Security Conference, given that they're clearly trying to build him up as some, I've heard him be compared to Nelson Mandela, of all people, on the BBC, CNN, and the propaganda media of NATO nations?
Yeah, well, this has become a trend, I guess, over the past few years. Of course, this isn't in the book as this happened more recently, but as we see with Juan Guaido from Venezuela or the case in Belarus, you know, there's a tendency to try to elect the leaders for other governments, much like what was done in Ukraine, by the way. Now, with Navalny, I think what's missing there, I guess, from the media is the nuance, because, of course, if someone from political opposition dies in prison, that the people have legitimate reasons to query, like why was he mistreated, for example. One should have transparency. But that being said, we can't pretend as if the West hasn't been using this for everything it's worth. And also, as you said, whitewashed him. I mean, I keep hearing references from people like Michael McFaul that he was the main opposition leader in Russia, and I hear this over and over again. But this is just objective reality is not correct. The main opposition is the Communist Party. Then you have many other political parties. He wasn't an opposition leader in this sense. And I don't think there was any chance of him taking power in Russia. So this is a very false narrative. And also, I guess, the way he's now portrayed as being this freedom fighter. Again, this is the... What happened to all this rhetoric of considering Muslims in the Caucasus as being cockroaches? I remember a lot from the Western media attempted to clear his name, saying, "Well, this was when he was younger and less experienced." But when they went back to interview him, he confirmed my opinions have not changed. So there's been a very strong effort to whitewash it, but it doesn't. It seems very naive or deceptive to suggest this is not politically motivated.
Professor Glenn Deason, I'll stop you there. More from the author of The Ukraine War and the Eurasian World Order after this break.
За военных, которые погибают, но они достойны защищать нашу родину.
По нам начали стрелять украинские. Мне ногу ранили. Вот так вот аж. Да чуть-чуть остался шрам.
Фашисты первыми наступали на нашу землю. А мы защищали ее, терпели, погибали. Но они все равно идут до победы.
I'm Scott Bennett. I'm a former United States Army psychological warfare officer who served in the State Department Counterterrorism Office under Ambassador Del Bailey. Boya.
Boya. So I wanted to come here to Russia, in the Donbass area, and gather the facts to take back to the American people. Well, Donbass is the front lines. This is where the bombs and the bullets are raging. This is where people are dying. This is where the buildings are exploding. So I wanted to see firsthand the scars of war.
Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Professor Glenn Deason, editor at Russia in Global Affairs and author of The Ukraine War and the Eurasian World Order. Professor Deason, we were just talking in part one about Navalny and the absurd comparisons being made in propaganda media in NATO nations. Navalny, of course, before he started marching with the Nazis in Russia, was funded by the National Endowment for Democracy. And you explain in this book, briefly and in passing, the way the US intelligence services act in terms of these NGOs to attempt the destruction of democracy around the world. Can you just go into that a little? Because the National Endowment for Democracy is routinely considered a great pro-democracy organization in NATO countries, as you know.
Well, this is one of the contradictions of liberal hegemony. So under liberal hegemony, the assumption is that liberal ideals can only elevate in the international system if it occurs under the leadership and hegemony of the United States. And so towards this end, to ensure hegemony, there's been, to a large extent, the corruption of civil society, because we argue that a true, free and open democracy, which you have to belong to the garden, then you have to have a strong civil society supported by NGOs. However, it's not enough. They have to be international NGOs. And it turns out that a lot of these NGOs are actually, they're not actually non-governmental. They are completely financed by government and often staffed by people who are former part of the intelligence community. Now, when it comes with the National Endowment for Democracy, it was actually established in 1983, and the opening speech, introduction speech, was given by Ronald Reagan, and he was very clear that this was a way of doing things in the open instead of hiding, because the CIA often got caught. It was quite embarrassing, and again, this is not really a big secret. You had the co-founder of the National Endowment for Democracy confirming that, you know, what the CIA used to do is what they do now. We have had many whistleblowers from the CIA who say that this is effectively a CIA operation. And it's a great way of interfering in other societies, because once you put all your money or put your money for interference into an NGO, which is allegedly about democracy, you now have source credibility. It's an institution working for good values. Whoever opposes it, you know, they're undermining democracy. So it has all the propaganda value you need. Also, it's selective by definition. They only look at the human rights and democracy issues in adversarial states. So suddenly, all great power politics is framed through the prism of human rights. So good values versus bad values, the democratic West versus the authoritarian rest. And so this becomes an instrument of propaganda, because there's no principles involved. Well, look at the current instance. Nobody cared, wanted even to report on Gonzalo Lira dying in a Ukrainian prison or on Julian Assange. But people like Navalny has to be, you know, whitewashed and become the new Mandela. So it shows that this is a way of corrupting civil society rather than actually building it.
And you use a lot of WikiLeaks' work in the book in terms of footnotes because, of course, Julian Assange revealed so many secrets, regardless of the case in London. And we've had the UN Special Rapporteur talking about his torture by British authorities. Is it to be expected that Washington and proxy Brussels and London and so on would all collaborate to try and assassinate the kind of people that appear in footnotes of the kinds of books you write? Is that to be expected now, that they will organise assassinations, as Julian Assange's defence team maintain?
Well, it depends. It depends who it will be. But of course, the CIA have been revealed to have had plans to kill Assange. So this is again an objective reality. But the problem is everything becomes politicized. If you recognize that like our side is committing these kind of crimes, it can be accused of assisting the adversary. Because it will take a related topic. If you criticize, for example, sanctions against Russia, that they don't work, which is reality, then you reduce trust in sanctions. And if you reduce trust in sanctions, that means you're assisting the Russians. So we always have the narratives which have to trump the facts. And I think this is, it goes back to the same problem.
Well, the odd thing is that even kind of US allies like India, which albeit does masses of trade since Putin decided to defend the people of eastern Ukraine, is getting annoyed by the National Endowment for Democracy a bit themselves. You quote quite at length from Foreign Minister Subramanian Jaishankar, explaining why now NATO hates democracy, presumably with the use of these, maybe we shouldn't call them NGOs, maybe we should call them GOs.
Yeah, the N definitely does not belong into that acronym. But yeah, this is a good example, because often this is portrayed as being a struggle simply between the US, its allies on one side, and its adversaries on the others. But as you see, and this is one of the features of the New World Order emerging, it's a multipolar system. So you have countries such as, countries who are friendly to the US as well, such as Turkey or India, as you mentioned, who would like to have to act as an independent polar power, which means they're not going to follow in the footsteps of the United States. So they're also becoming more and more cautious now of these instruments of hegemony, which are not just economic, military, and political, but it's also the manipulation of civil society. And this is what the Indians were commenting upon, or the foreign minister, when effectively called this manipulation. And it's not even a civilizing mission in terms of bringing human rights and democracy. It is a way of manipulating policies and essentially aligning their policies with the United States.
And along with all these geopolitical, geostrategic, military changes, you see signs of US collapse in NATO nation culture in this book. I mean, we've talked on this program about how Russian writers, composers, artists have been banned in the wake of the move to protect people in Ukraine by Russia. And you quote, a lesson from ancient Rome was that civilizations, much like stars, shine the strongest. Is before they die, presumably, is what you mean. What sort of dangers, this is 500 years we're talking about, so what sort of dangers and how short-term are these dangers going to be? Are Washington and EU proxies going to realise it's a case of nuclear weapons as their only option, given they are failing to sanction Russia, failing to prevent China from becoming a preeminent economic superpower, and so on?
Yeah, well, just first in terms of the civilizations shining the brightest.
I mean, Russian writers, artists being banned by NATO countries, of course, not by Russia.
Yeah. Well, this is also because hegemons, they lose priority. Once there's no more adversaries, there's no more priorities being made, and you see the excesses beginning to tear away. The conflict with in Ukraine, obviously, I think is also a good indication of how they fail to do the proper priorities, because the amount of the possibilities they had to maximize security was there all along, and instead they always picked the route to maximize power instead. And I think there's been a a willful ignorance, if you will, of how what the strengths of Russia's are and what the weakness of themselves are.
And their reaction to populism, as they call it, Trump, Orban and others, of these liberal elites is to obviously try and tie them to the enemy. It's been Russia for a while. Presumably they'll all be tied to China soon. Is it their version of... I mean, we mentioned Gramsci a lot, and this book clearly uses words like hegemony and civil society a lot, and interregnum that we're in, that you posit. So is that their way of talking about how terrible the interregnum is, this populist situation where someone like Trump is gaining so much popularity and other populist figures who will no doubt gain in popularity as economies decline in Western Europe?
Yeah, and the interregnum I refer to us because, well, this is the source of all our conflicts now. It's the world order's shifting. So the Americans are trying to pull it back to unipolarity, while most of the non-NATO world is trying to pull it towards multipolarity. And it's in this friction that all the rules are collapsing, which is why we're having the crisis we do. But populism is become a key problem within the West, because not everyone is marching in the same tact anymore. And this is also something I drew parallels to in the 19th century, because after a period of globalization, it's quite common that you have some winners of globalizations and some who have lost out. For example, in Europe, the farmers, or in the US, the industrial, the industry workers. And in this instance, you create a huge divide between the elites and the people. And it's this is why after globalization in the 19th century and now, you have the emergence of certain populists who are essentially saying that these policies the elites are pushing, which are globalist by definition, are no longer in the interest of the people. And so populism can be a mechanism for addressing the shift from the elites, which doesn't necessarily represent the people to the
Except there's one difference from that over this 500 years since Westphalia, and I should say some British historians consider the birth of nationalism, nation states earlier, just, you know, because I am British. The difference is, isn't it, and you mentioned Zuckerberg and Facebook, is that the tools they now have to censor, suppress information, to surveil, are so much greater than ever before. Could they not, as Zuckerberg has tried to get the United States to do, to increase private-public use of technology to further the aims of the CIA, to pick one agency, can they not do that and dumb down in a truly Orwellian, Aldous Huxley-style way and destroy the minds of everyone in Western Europe?
This is a real problem. Again, this is why the problems we face today are not that dissimilar from the problems after the First World War, because you now have the political class beginning to go more hand in hand with the main industries, which are now the digital tech giants. Now, Zuckerberg, of course, is a very interesting example because, you know, when you had all these issues on the Russiagate about disinformation and propaganda, then, of course, you know, he came to the government and said, listen, we are not your enemies. You don't have to regulate us. We will work with you. Because disinformation is a problem coming from Russia, China, and Iran, you know, nowhere else. So he tends to identify these key issues of misinformation as linked solely to the adversary of the United States. So you see corporate interest and government beginning to merge more and more. And once you have this, which effectively is by definition a fascist political economy, you have very little power left for the people in this relationship. Because once, against corporations and government go hand in hand, the people have very little to stand up for. So I would say there's a good reason why people are so gung-ho for any war seemingly that comes their way.
Professor Glenn Deason, thank you.
My pleasure.
And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those surviving the killing in all NATO-backed wars. The new book, The Ukraine War and the Eurasian World Order, is out now. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country. And head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.